everyone, and welcome back to Makerspace, a podcast produced by Christian Education National. My name is Sam, and in this episode, I had the privilege of sharing a conversation with Cara Martin. Cara, it turns out, does a lot of different things for work, but mainly works as a practical theologian and author, writing on what it means for organizations to stay on mission and how to be faithful within our work. In this episode, I ask her questions based on her book, Keeping Faith, How Christian Organizations Can Stay True to the Way of Jesus. So we talk about power, mission drift, leadership beyond niceness, risky faithfulness, and how organizations can meaningfully enact grace, forgiveness, and confession. There is a lot here for school leaders to mull over, so I think this would be a good one to share. But here is my chat with Cara. All right, well, I'm very excited to be sitting down with Cara Martin today, who I've just met, but I have heard speak, and I've watched some videos, and I've also read. So I've also done my homework with you, which is nice to be able to sit down and talk to the person behind this stuff. So thank you for coming out to have this conversation.
It's my absolute delight, Sam.
And you've had a bit to do with CEN in the past, but I've just discovered in chatting to you just before that you do a lot of things with a lot of organisations. So I wondered if you could just maybe rattle a few of those things off so we get a kind of sense for how many pies you have your fingers in at the moment.
Yes, I'm a lecturer, so with several colleges. So just as an example, this year I taught with Gordon Conwell College in Boston in the US. I taught with Mary Andrews College in Sydney. I taught with Trinity College from Melbourne, and I taught for the Bible College of Malaysia. Probably the ones I teach most regularly with are Mary Andrews College and Gordon Conwell. I'm an adjunct professor with Gordon Conwell, so That's one of my big claims to fame. I'm also a writer. I write books and I write articles. I'm also a mentor and coach. So I mentor officially for Regent College in Vancouver as part of their MALTS program there, their leadership program. I also do a fair amount of mentoring and coaching with the Salvation Army and with an organization called SEED, and also with the Women's Leadership Network. What else do I do? I'm on the board of the Theology of Work Project, which is an organisation I really admired before I was asked to come on the board. So I really enjoy what that project does in taking the Bible and showing people how much it talks about our ordinary work. So I love working with them. And, you know, wife, mother, all that sort of stuff as well. But I get invited to speak at different places, and it's a real joy to do that.
Awesome. Well, it's great that we can have you here too. It sounds like from what you've said, but also reading up on you, that you've kind of over time seemed to have narrowed on this bit of niche around the theology of work, and really thought deeply about not having a separation between what we do on Sunday and what we do everywhere else. Would that be fair that that's kind of emerged?
Yeah. I think that is probably the thing for which I'm best known. And that's, I guess it's been a lifelong ambition from the first time I walked into a workplace and sort of suddenly thought, how as a Christian do I operate in this space? And then struggled to find resources or help. I've basically spent the rest of my life trying to answer that question of how we do this well. And so, yes, workship is probably one of the things I'm best known for, which is a couple of books that I've written that look at how our work can also be worship to God. So there is a CEN school in Victoria where some of the people there who really studied and enjoyed that book sign off their emails, yours in workship.
Love it. Love it.
Just as a reminder to each other that that's how we can see our work.
That's great. Well, I became first aware of you actually through your book, Keeping Faith, that you co-authored. And it's become quite an important text to what seems like quite a number of organisations. And extremely relevant for us at CEN, because what you're really talking about is mission drift and how an organization stays faithful to the gospel. And that's a conversation that needs to keep happening. It needs to, every generation needs to ask again, why do we do what we do in the ways that we do them? So I wondered whether you could maybe even just define the terms around what do we mean by mission drift, and then what do we mean by organizational faithfulness?
Yeah, that's cool. Well, I guess the reality is, and the studies have shown, that the tendency for most Christian organizations is over time to lose their Christian distinctiveness. Mm. You could call that a tendency towards secularization. It used to be that it would take about 100 years. Mm. The time frame's getting shorter and shorter. And a lot of people have done study. Peter Greer is one of the better known ones in his book called Mission Drift, about what is the tendency towards that? How does that happen and why does that happen? I guess what we were concerned about, a piece that we felt was missing from the conversation, was this idea of organizational faithfulness. Yeah. That the idea that we need to think biblically and theologically about how our organizations function. And we felt that the drift towards unfaithfulness, there are some key things, some key markers that people have captured that can lead to that. But we felt there was also this missing idea of looking with a deep biblical and theological lens at how we function as Christian organisations.
Mm. Mm. Can I ask why you think the time frame of drift has shortened? Mm. That's quite interesting.
I think it's because there are more and more pressures on organisations, external pressures. Mm. I think it was easier for organisations when they were in a general culture that actually embraced a lot of their ideas and what they did. But increasingly, particularly in the West and, I guess in the Global South, there are different sorts of pressures at work. We're actually seeing that there's a bit more antagonism mm. to the ideas of Christian organisations. So unfortunately, there's this sort of idea that, we love your charities, we love your schools, we love the good work you do, but can you not bring religion into it? And it's like, well, actually religion is the basis on which we do this. In Australia, there's a particular sort of flavour to it, because one of the problems has been, and the opportunity is that the government has increasingly outsourced its charity work to Christian organisations and schooling, education to Christian organisations. And so we receive government funding for a lot of the work that we do. And with that funding comes a bit of tension about how that money is used and what the expectations are that come with that money. So I think that adds an extra flavour of pressure, pressure to conform, pressure to fit in, pressure not to make waves, pressure just to, dumb down what we do or not refer to the Christian mission that the organisations actually started off with.
Hmm. Obviously that's very relevant for a school, because when we start to talk about pedagogy, when we start to talk about the school's mission statement or philosophy, it's very easy to not even think about it and start to define the school in terms of things like excellence, or we can do this just like all the other schools. But it becomes very important to be able to articulate to parents, I think, especially, this is what we're actually about. And I love the way that the book kind of starts, where you start to ask the question, like, what makes an organization Christian? Is it the value statement or the statement of beliefs or that kind of thing? Or is it more than that? And I don't know if you saw, but, Tom Holland recently said, the problem that the church has is that it's one. It's like everyone sort of agrees with charity and looking after the poor and education in general. And he says, actually, it presents us with a responsibility to do the things that only the church can do. So I don't know whether you want to riff off that a little bit and say, actually, no, yeah, we do need to do something more than that.
Yeah, I like what you say about the tendency to focus on academic excellence in particular as one of those areas. Or even you'll get parents who are saying, you know, I want my child to have character and that's why I send it to the school. But they don't want their child to get religion necessarily. So that's where the issues come in. And I think some Christian schools have started up almost alongside what were the church schools. So there's so many church schools around that were denominational schools. And that drift that we're referring to has become evident in those schools where they're better known for their distinguished alumni and how much money they raise and the academic excellence and what it means to be able to name that school on your CV rather than the Christian emphasis that that school originally had. And I think some Christian schools have felt, well, you know, well, we're not going to fall into that trap. And yet, I think you have to be really intentional and really conscious and really aware not to fall into that trap, because I think there are just shifts that happen over time. The first generation of a school, you know, if the founder's involved and the initial families are involved, then that culture stays really strong. And, you know, it's really evident what's going on. I think one of the real key moments for schools and even groups of schools that have been formed is when the founding leader or the key leader moves on. That's a really big shift where some of that important culture and ethos can be lost.
Well, speaking of leadership, you mentioned briefly in the book some quite well-known examples of Christian leadership that has gone awry, if we want to use that light word. And I think that's a pretty significant thing to note, where there can be quite a pragmatic mentality sometimes of, as long as we get the job done for Jesus, it kind of doesn't matter how we get there. So you're either on the bus or under the bus. And I wondered if you could speak to... leadership seems like such a crucial point in which this all plays out. And so I wondered if you could speak to this power and authority piece in, within organisations a little bit.
I'd love to, because this is a key thing that I'm pretty strong on. And yes, I have listened to the Mars Hill documentary also. I think this is one of the areas where Christian schools in particular can actually really stand out. And a lot of them do. So I'm working with a couple of school networks at the moment where their leaders are really distinctive in their humble leadership. And I think that that's a gift that Christian schools can actually bring. Unfortunately, our models for leadership generally are sort of the hero leader model. I think that's actually not a helpful model. That's not who I see Jesus being.
Yeah, and so what do you think is in us that continually is attracted to that?
I think because it gives us a strong sense of security when we have a strong leader. It gives us a sense of, someone who's got vision, who's taking us somewhere. What that can do, though, often is end up with an issue around power. And I'm glad you mentioned power, because I think this is one of the key areas where it can all come undone. So I think what the Bible teaches about power is that power is something that should flow through rather than something that we should hold on to. So if we see God in creation, he is obviously sovereign and powerful, and he creates the world. But the power sort of goes through him into the things he creates. So, for example, everything he creates has the possibility of regeneration, of taking on a life of its own and being able to sort of recreate itself in many ways. And then there's that beautiful thing where he makes humanity his vice-regents. He's willing to give us power to steward this world under his authority. Basically, with almost with his stamp of authority on us, with the same recognition that he has, which is just an incredibly generous way to do it. I see with Jesus the same sort of thing, where he has access, he's human, yet he has access to power to heal, to transform. But that power comes through him to others. And I think of that moment, you know, where the woman's been bleeding for 12 years and she comes up and she touches his cloak. And Jesus can feel the power go out of him into her to heal her. And he stops and he has a conversation with her. But that's what Jesus does all the time. He empowers other people. And even that moment where he stops and talks to her, he is actually reinstating her in terms of her status within society. He's raising her up. And that's, I think, the model of Christian leadership, which we can model in schools, that we don't hold on to the power, but we allow the power to go through us to empower others. And I see the leaders in Christian schools who are like that. It's beautiful to see, because they're not trying to hold on to their power. They're not trying to create a power base. They're not trying to create a kingdom of their own on earth, which I think a school can become if you're not careful. But they're actually seeking to empower others, the leadership teams, the families, the students. They're actually being the means through which flourishing can come in and through and continue to perpetuate. And I think if we can model that sort of leadership, I see other schools where, you know, the principal is almost worshipped. And, you know, they have certain expectations of how they'll be deferred to and so on. And that sort of leadership model, I think, is really unhealthy and unhelpful.
Well, to sort of take it back to explicitly the organisational drift part, or the mission drift, I wondered, I mean, you've thought a lot about this. We do drift in different ways, but if you're in different parts of the world, you'd be drifting to different things.
Yeah.
And so I wondered if you've got any thoughts, because you're in contact with people all over the world about this stuff. What specifically, I'd say New Zealand and Australia are pretty similar. What do you think in this part of the world it is that we often are tempted to drift into away from the gospel?
Yeah. I think it can be a really subtle thing. I think when our schools are more focused either on, you've said before, academic excellence or money, I think either of those things can be things that can distract us from the main mission of why the school exists. I think if we're more concerned about keeping everyone happy than having honest and frank discussions, or being really open about the Christian heritage of the place, then I think that can be an issue. The idea of kowtowing to the donor who gives a lot of money to the school, you know, that's a very seductive thing that we can do. And then it can just, whatever that donor's interests or their particular concerns, can become the thing that begins to drive the school. So I think there are subtle things like that. I think the government has certain requirements as well, what schools will talk about and what they won't talk about, or how openly they talk about things. I think there's a whole load of pressures around that need to be understood and, dealt with. Even issues of who do we employ? Can we employ only Christian staff? Is that what we want to do? Or do we think that we can employ anyone we want?
Can I push into that a little bit more?
Sure.
Because that is a very live conversation, especially with regional areas where it's hard to employ people. And some schools are presented with, well, maybe we can't run this particular, you know, program because we can't find personnel. Can we just get a good maths teacher if they don't believe? So, I mean, what do you say to people in that position?
Okay, well, maybe I'll be controversial here. I don't know.
Go for it.
But I think what makes a Christian organization is not necessarily that everyone's Christian. And I've seen organizations where everyone's Christian, for example, a church, which actually have not acted in very Christian ways. And so have ended up going off track or deforming people or, you know, a whole range of things, have not been a terrific witness to the gospel and in fact have probably harmed the gospel message, possibly for a generation. So it's not just that you've got all Christian staff that guarantees that you're Christian. I think it is possible to have people who sign up to the Christian ethos of the school and who teach or who do maintenance or who do a hospitality service at school, whatever, and can also become in part the mission field for the school. So one of the writers of the book, Stephen Judd, used to head up an organisation called Hammond Care, which is an independent Christian organisation that cares for vulnerable people, has a speciality of people with dementia, has various ways of looking after people in those situations and some hospitals and so on. They can't run their organisation and only employ Christian staff. It's just not physically possible to get enough staff to run all their aged care centres and so on. But their Christian ethos is so strong that they're still able to be an identifiably Christian organisation where the mission is clear. And I know one person in particular, who's my sister, who doesn't identify as a Christian, but she loves Jesus more because she's been connected with this organisation. So they've made it clear that their particular care for people is informed by Jesus's care for people and concern for people. And so she understands it. That's why they do the work they do and why they have a spirit of excellence in that care and why they encourage her to be imaginative in providing that care and give her the initiative to be able to go out of her way to care for people, because that's what Jesus does. And so she is, as a pre-Christian, I'll say, employee, is attracted to Jesus because of the way that organisation is run. That's what I think, you know, a really organisationally faithful Christian organisation, that's what it can do. Mm. It can actually still be faithful to its mission and so on, regardless of whether or not everybody who's employed there is a Christian, and the people who are pre-Christian who are employed can actually be part of who is drawn to the gospel, as well as the clients, as well as the families, students in the case of schools. However, having said that, you do need a core of people who are Christian, and you need a board that really understands and gets the mission. Probably it would be good if the vast majority of them were Christian. You need a leadership team who understand and live and breathe the mission, and understand that not from a, well, that's a nice thing, but actually a living, breathing relationship with Jesus sort of situation. So you do need critical people in critical places who are Christian. And I think that would be sort of, that would be at least, the basis on which you go forward in that, the minimum, I guess, requirement.
Mm. So to then press into what it might mean for an organisation to exhibit that stuff, your book identifies three areas that are really key to basically have at the front of your mind as you make those sort of decisions around employment and what the school stands for, what the organisation stands for. You've identified those as ethos, identity, and impact. Mm. So Yeah, I just wonder if we can spend a bit of time on that, because that's very different to saying, oh, we've got a belief statement, or we've got, you know, just values. You're saying, no. It needs to sort of permeate through everything you do. It's the way you do things. And so that's your ethos, your identity, and your impact. So are you able to speak to that for a little bit?
I'd love to. Yeah, I think this is a really important part of delving deeper into these ideas of what actually makes an organization Christian. So if we look at the identity is who the organization is and its history and why it exists. So the who and the why are part of that identity component. So understanding the history, where it came from, and retelling that history, retelling the story of where the organization came from is really important. The next area is ethos, and that's sort of the spirit and the culture behind the organization. And that's more the how we do stuff. And that's probably the area sometimes which gets dropped in the Christian conversation. So, you know, there may be an understanding of who or why we exist, but then how we do things, sometimes we don't shine that biblical theological lens on. So you can develop a culture that can end up being quite alien to who you say you are, and that's where you get, you know, these accusations of hypocrisy and so on, and that's where you often see churches, for example, go astray, where the how they function is not consistent with who they are and why they exist. And then the last area is impact. What's the impact that it's having? And that's the sort of what, that's the details of the activities it does. So in a Christian school, obviously it's that whole process of education. But it's sort of, the impact may be, the financial impact of that organisation as well, that's part of it. I don't want to separate out the finance thing from the Christian identity thing, because I think we sometimes do that. It's this sort of dualistic view of that money thing that's sort of not part of the sacred agenda. So we'll just put that to one side. But no, actually, it's part of the whole. We need to think about that as well. But the danger is when you focus on those activities, the what the organisation does and its impact, and that gets separated out from who or why we exist or the ethos or the spirit of the organisation. So we say it's like a Venn diagram, and organisational faithfulness is at the heart of all those three things. So there needs to be a consistency between all those three areas.
Great. Well, I really enjoyed where the book starts to go after you've made all those definitions. And you say some things that I think are pretty challenging, I think, but completely necessary. And so you start to talk about grace, and you've talked about forgiveness, and then you've talked about things like truth and confession. And as I was reading, I thought, oh no, this is the stuff, because we can have procedures that are correct, but that doesn't necessarily reflect the gospel in the way we do it. So I was quite moved by what you guys were saying around actually a Christian organization being a place of forgiveness in which you don't hold things against people, or a place of grace where you've got the requirements, but you're actually allowed to go beyond those things and extend that to people. And then also a safe place for people to be truthful about where they've messed up maybe, or where they're at, and to be able to hold those things, which that's deeply uncomfortable. That is risky. But you've talked about that too. So, I mean, I've just thrown a lot at you, and that represents about 40 pages of your book.
Yeah.
So, but that's quite inspiring. So, yeah. I mean, I don't know whether you want to unpack a bit of that.
Yeah. I think it's one of the things that I really struggle with Christian organisations, having worked in corporate worlds and other places, is... in Christian organisations, we're mostly just nice. And that's actually not a virtue. There's no virtue of niceness.
Yeah.
And what niceness does, it covers up a whole load of mess often. So because we're nice, we'll do things like we won't address conflict. Because we're nice, we'll just be nice to each other, even if we don't disagree. We'll just be nice and we'll just hope it goes away. and conflict rarely goes away. But there's almost this sense of, well, I can't have conflict because that wouldn't be Christian. And yet, if we look at Jesus and how he dealt with other religious figures, I mean, he was pretty tough with religious figures. He called out stuff all the time. He wasn't scared of having a discussion or an argument, and he raised things all the time.
The sons of the devil.
Ooh. Yeah.
Have you ever brought that one out in a staff meeting?
Oh, man. Okay, that would be really interesting. I'm just quoting the Bible.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think what we're trying to encourage people to do is actually let this permeate through. Let's be a place where we can have real conversations, where we can have honest discussions and not just have conflict for the sake of conflict, but conflict can be really constructive. And conflict that is sort of pushed down and ignored ends up just blowing up into something huge. But yeah, we need to be able to have honest and open and frank discussions and to model that. And there are times where I think what we do is if there's a mistake made, we'll cover it up. And I think that's one of the worst things you can do in a Christian organization for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons is when it's uncovered, which eventually it usually is, then it just looks really deceitful. It doesn't look like the organization has integrity. But the second reason is it means that if people think I can't make a mistake, then they'll cover up their own mistakes. And that also has a snowballing effect. But if, for example, a leader stands up and says, hey, I want to just admit here I made a mistake. I thought this was going to work out. This hasn't gone the way I hoped it would. Stuffed up. I ask your forgiveness. I ask the forgiveness of the community. We led astray. Here are the things we're going to do to get us back on track. I think modelling that sort of behaviour is amazing in a school because it says, okay, we're human. We sin. Okay, where's our doctrine of sin in all this? It exists. We make mistakes. We stuff up. We think something's going to work and it doesn't work. Rather than covering it up or hiding it or pretending it didn't happen, let's admit that and say, you know, we tried that. I do a lot of mentoring of entrepreneurs, and one of the things that we talk to entrepreneurs about is failing fast. In other words, okay, you're probably going to fail at some things, but what you do is you admit you fail early on. You don't cover it up and keep going and hope it comes right. And then you say, right, what have we learned from that? And once we've learned something from that, okay, what do we do next? I think those sort of open, gracious conversations and ways of working have a profound impact, but they also talk to the gospel. They illustrate the gospel. They illustrate, okay, you know, we're human, we stuff up because we live in a sin-permeated world. Mm. We need to ask for forgiveness. We need to extend grace, have grace extended to us and extend grace to others, and then we need to move on. I think our Christian environments could be transformed if instead of just being nice, we were actually kind, gentle, admitted mistakes, extended forgiveness, showed grace, took risks, all those things.
I mean, because that's quite robust, isn't it? You've got a community now that can handle truth and stay in a very loving kind of relationship with one another, which is very rare.
I'll tell you another thing. One of the things that we do is we think that grace is ignoring the fact that someone's not performing well. That's another area I see that Christians do all the time. And we think it's gracious just to let them keep going. I think that causes a whole load of problems. It causes problems for whoever is experiencing the work of that underperforming person because, like, they're not getting the best. If it's a teacher or if it's an accountant or whatever, there's other people who are impacted by that underperformance. It's also not helping the person who's underperforming. It'd be much better to actually have a frank conversation with that person, see if you can actually improve the performance. And maybe if you can't improve the performance, you're doing your organization and that person a favor by saying, perhaps there is not a future in this organization. Now, those sort of conversations are really scary. And when I say underperforming, sometimes there are really good reasons for underperformance. Like, I'm not talking about if someone is, you know, unwell or something's happened or a crisis.
You talk about it in the book. It's someone who's suffering from quite like a big mental health thing. And actually, at that point, it's okay to kind of nurture them a little bit.
Absolutely. A Christian organization at that point actually cares for the vulnerable person. But if someone's just not really suited or fit to the organization, I think often we think the Christian thing is just to let them keep going. What that can do is end up with that person just, often they're uncomfortable as well, because they know they're not doing as well. They're not flourishing in that environment. And sometimes being transitioned out of the organization enables them to find a place where they can truly flourish.
Yeah. Mm. You've got here this you call it risky faithfulness, which I really liked because that's a major temptation, really, isn't it? To do what will keep everyone happy, to keep the ship afloat, which is not necessarily obedience. And it's not necessarily good stewardship. It's doing what... It's maintenance. And actually, it kind of reveals a sort of faith that maybe doesn't trust God with the organization, but actually says, oh, we need to... Sort of sounds like the parable of the talents in a little bit of a way, really. So, you know, have you got any stories where you've seen actually leaders do this well, this risky faithfulness stuff, and actually taken this risk, but because they actually felt this is the right thing for the organization, even if it's hard?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I think that is really surprising is that most of the organizations that we're talking about, schools and charities, etc., would not have even got off the ground if people didn't take risks, big risks. Risks often with people's own money, or they've gone guarantor, or risks in terms of people devoting themselves to this sort of stuff. That's how organizations, Christian organizations, get started. And yet we get to a point where we're all about minimizing risk, reputation risk or whatever. And sometimes that steps over into risk avoidance. And I think that's the tendency of most organizations. They get to a point where they are trying to avoid any sort of risk. I think Christian organizations should be known for taking risks. And that can be in employing certain people. It can be in doing certain activities. It can be in a range of things. But we need to enable people. Mm. Now, by that, I don't mean... You know, we do things that are dangerous.
yeah.
But it's like considered faithful risk management rather than anything else. What's interesting, I was working this year with an organization, and one of the things they wanted to develop was a theology of risk. And so went through the process of doing that with them. Then we came, and the organization, the staff, we're part of that and we're developing that. And then we had this big day where people could come and move around different stations, look at these different theologies that we'd developed for the organization, including this theology of risk. And the board were involved in that too. And it was the first time the board had really sort of delved deeply into these theologies. So we had groups of staff and board members gathered around these different areas. What was fascinating was that it was the board members who were saying, I think you could go further with that theology of risk.
Wow.
And the staff members were really surprised. Mm. Now, who ultimately has responsibility or authority for risk at a governance sort of level is the board. The board are the owners of the risk. They're the ones who need to make sure that the organisation manages risk well. And yet it was the board who was saying, you can be more risky. And the staff, because they were so nervous about this area and knowing that the board were responsible for it, had become really risk adverse. So that was such an important conversation to have.
Do you think it's best done with, for example, if it's a school, with teachers and the board together?
Yeah, I think that, I think with the developing of these organisational theologies, the ways I've been involved with organisation, including schools, is start at the staff and move upwards. Because the danger is if you start at the board and go down, the board is not really across the day-to-day happenings within the organisation. And the staff will tend to think, well, the board have said this, so we have to do it. If you start with the staff and even involving the wider school community and move up, ultimately the leadership, executive and the board have to be responsible for it, but it enables them to come in at a later stage and it allows a more free conversation. I think it's something that would be good to begin at the staff level and then sort of feed upwards. I think that would be very fruitful. And it leads to more robust conversations. Yeah. Just as an example on that one, how the danger of starting at the board and going down is, so for this organisation that I was working with, one of the theologies they wanted was a theology of a prophetic voice. And that was really fascinating. So they were really sure they wanted this in. So their concept of being a prophetic voice was speaking truth to power and speaking God's word. When it got up to the board were, is this really important? Like, we've never heard this before. They were really surprised at it. But it turned out that a big percentage of the staff had joined the organisation because they thought it had the potential to be a prophetic voice.
Oh, interesting.
So that was an indication where there was just this misunderstanding between the board and the staff about what was really core and important to the organisation. So that's why I think going from bottom up can be a really helpful process.
Yeah. It's probably a bit of a cheeky question given your line of work, but do you think organisations, let's say particularly schools, need to be friendly with theologians in this kind of way?
Yeah, it's one of the things that we say that it's a bit of a risk in terms of Christian organisations. One of the ways they can drift into unfaithfulness. The phrase of some people who've studied this, they talk about a vapid humanism where you just sort of talk about stuff and you don't want to insult anyone, so you end up just being nice to everyone in the ways that you frame things. And I think there's a real danger in that. So one of the things that we talk about is the need to get clergy and theologians involved in the organisations. Now, I know CEN actually have a heart to do that, and it's one of the great benefits of having an organisation like yours is that you can bring theologians and thought leaders into the space and challenge things. I do think it's helpful. I do think it's important. I think it's good to have that at a board level, just to question and test and poke and remind people what the Bible has to say on this, what Christian history has to say on some of this stuff as well. Because actually there's rich resources there that probably we haven't tapped. I think the danger is that we see the Bible as just that place where, you know, we'll have a devotion or we'll choose a verse at the right time. But actually thinking much more deeply about some of the current issues that face schools, we need to do that, and to do that in environments where we have theologians and practitioners working together on that.
I really like that you've used the term prophetic voice. I think for some people they might hear all sorts of things with that. I mean, really what we're saying is asking the question, you know, who are we? And can we remember what we're here for and, you know, where that is? I guess what I'd be interested to ask is there anything that you would say if you were given a forum in front of all the Christian schools of Australia, that you'd say, oh, be careful about this? Like, what would your prophetic message be if you were given that opportunity? Which is a big question, and I didn't actually tell you I was going to ask you that. So we can skip it. But
No. I think there's a real opportunity. I see the whole Christian education sector. In many ways, Christian schools have replaced the role of the church. Now, I'm going to say, I want to be careful about this because I'm not saying they replace the church. I'm saying that in society, they have replaced the role of the church. So whereas the church, you know, you'd see a clergy person would be invited along to key community events and so on. It's often school principals who are invited along. Mm. If there's some sort of emergency, a fire or something, where do people gather? They used to gather at a church, now they'll gather at the school. Schools used to just educate kids, but now they educate parents as well. So where you go for marriage advice to a church, to a pastor, you now go to a course at a school. So schools have these big functions within societies, have become the heart of communities in a way I think churches used to be. So there's a wonderful, wonderful opportunity there. That opportunity could be lost in some ways if we don't remember our identity and our purpose as Christian organisations to continue the mission of Christ on earth. So there's opportunities there to be about places of flourishing within the community and what does that look like. Places where the vulnerable feel like grace is extended to them and they can be cared for. Places where it's a safe place to have difficult conversations. All those things I would hope Christian schools could be, because I think Christian schools probably in our society, maybe alongside Christian charities, that's where society cannot avoid the rubbing points. You know, that's where we have the greatest connection with broader society and the greatest opportunity to continue to influence broader society.
Well, as we are sort of coming into land a little bit, is there anything you could say, I guess, how do you stay on mission personally? You know, what is it that you do to keep, I guess, you know, it's the question we all have to ask. How do we keep the main thing for us at an individual level as well? What is it that you do to foster that within yourself?
It's a beautiful question. Thank you. Yeah, I think it's an important question. I remember the late, great Tim Keller. He was being asked about how he, as a leader, continued to stay on track and was being asked about sort of the rise and fall of Mars Hill type scenario. And one of the things he said was, you know, his church as an organisation, you know, it had all these protective measures in these denominational things. And so schools have boards and church connections that help keep it narrow. And he personally, you know, he talked about some friends that he was accountable to. And then, of course, his wife, Kathy. Mm. But he said, in spite of all of that, he could easily go astray. So he was saying just the importance of communion with God. And I think that's the thing that is the thing that keeps me on track as much as possible. So I have daily practices of Bible reading and prayer and examination, reflection on myself. I have a weekly practice of the Sabbath where I shut down my computer and I don't look at it. And I find that really hard because my work is diverse. And
you're probably really interested in it
I am. I am. I love it. But I know that I need to do that practice as a time of reflecting on God and also sort of keeping the main things. Focusing on my family and restoring myself. So yeah, I think those regular practices are important. I have someone I walk with almost weekly, and we're accountable to each other and we pray together. And we're across each other's sort of challenges and opportunities. Mm. I think all those things are important. And I think also I notice things. I have a monthly prayer letter I send out, because I think every Christian needs a mission letter that they send out. We all need people to pray for us and to talk to about different things. And one of the things that does, it just reminds me when I'm tempted to go off track a little bit. So even things that are good, we're surrounded by good things to do. But one of the things that I became conscious of this year, as a way of sort of trying to control things, I'm wrestling with God for control all the time. Mm-hmm. I thought I'll take up this offer of some work to do because, you know, it pays okay. But it wasn't really aligned with what I should do. And I realized that that was just a distraction. So, yeah, just being the process of this monthly newsletter just reminded me of, okay, what's the main purpose? What am I actually supposed to be about? What has God gifted me for? What has he asked me to do? And just to dwell on that and to make sure I stay true to that.
Great. Well, is there anything that you'd like to just add to the conversation before we finish it off? Because, you know, you've obviously got a lot to offer. Just to, for anyone listening and who's thinking deeply about the same sort of things.
I guess what I would love Christian schools to do, most Christian schools that I've interacted with have a great either philosophy or theology of education, Christian education. What does it mean to do education, and what does it mean to do that in a Christian way? I would love that same focus to be turned inwards to how the organisation functions. Mm. One of the things I notice is that almost everything that school wants to say about who it is and how it sets up is focused on students. And that's the main audience, and their families, of course. But how does the organisation itself function? We've got to really reflect deeply on that. And I think that is one of the key areas and key ideas of how a Christian organisation can stay true to the way of Jesus.
It's challenging. Well, Cara, thank you so much for coming over and chatting with me. It's been really nice to meet you, and just very grateful that there's someone like you in the ecosystem doing this kind of work and making yourself available in these ways. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam. I love the work you do too.
Cool. Cheers.
Thanks for joining. If you're keen to keep learning and accessing more of CEN's resources, why not subscribe to the Christian Teachers Journal, a publication of the National Institute for Christian Education, the postgraduate arm of CEN. Go to CEN's website, which is in the show notes, and under publications, you can take out an annual subscription to CTJ and receive your own copy of the 4 editions. From time to time, you might even find some writing from our podcast guests. See you next time.